In 1968, five black girls were picked up by police after running away from a reform school in Mount Meigs, Alabama. I'm writer and reporter Josie Duffy Rice, and in a new podcast, I investigate the abuse that thousands of black children suffered at the Alabama Industrial School for Negro Children and how those five girls changed everything. Listen to Unreformed on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
In 1980, cocaine was captivating and corrupting Miami.
The cartels, they just killed everybody that was home.
Setting an aspiring private investigator on a collision course with corruption and multiple murders.
The detective agency would turn out to be a front for our drug pilot, who would claim he did it all for the CIA.
I'm Lauren Bright Pacheco. Join me for Murder in Miami.
Talk about walking into the devil's den.
Listen to Murder in Miami on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
On the new podcast, The Turning, Room of Mirrors, we look beneath the delicate veneer of American ballet and the culture formed by its most influential figure, George Balanchine.
He used to say, "What are you looking at, dear? You can't see you, only I can see you."
What you're doing is larger than yourself, almost like a religion.
Like he was a god.
Listen to The Turning, Room of Mirrors on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
On October 29, 1996, Elkhart, Indiana police were called to the apartment of a Michael Kirshner and his mother, Nona Cannell. Allegedly, while they and four friends were watching a movie, two men forced their way in, demanding money and drugs. After the taller of the pair allegedly shot at his friends and missed, a struggle between Michael Kirshner and the shooter resulted in a non-fatal gunshot wound to Michael's abdomen. The gunman's hat fell off during the struggle, and the two assailants fled. The police collected no evidence from the scene, but took statements from the witnesses and victims who described the shooter as tall and skinny, carrying a long silver gun, and the other man as short and stocky, with no weapon. 2 days later, one of the witnesses, Eddie Love, allegedly identified a short and stocky man named Chris Parrish. About 3 months later, a suspected purse snatcher named Keith Cooper was identified as the taller shooter from a photo lineup. Even though the jury was presented with DNA results from the sweatband of the shooter's hat that were allegedly inconclusive, the identifications appeared conclusive enough to separately convict both men. But this is wrongful conviction. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction. Today we're going to tell the story of a man who was wrongfully convicted in a place that, well, with what has been uncovered there already, in such a small population, it just might be the per capita wrongful conviction capital of this country, and therefore the world. A dubious distinction. And I'm talking about Elkhart, Indiana. But first, let's introduce the man himself, Keith Cooper. I mean, Keith, I'm sorry you're here because of the reason why you're here and what you had to go through, but I'm really happy and honored that you're here with us today.
I'm glad to be here.
And with him is his civil attorney and our resident Elkhart expert, who you might remember from our coverage of Andy Royer's case, which we're going to have linked in the bio. This man is an adjunct professor at Notre Dame Law, a staff attorney at the Exoneration Clinic out of the University of Chicago, and a partner at the nationally recognized civil rights law firm Loewy & Loewy, where he was an investigator before he even passed the bar. That's some impressive resume, and we're honored to have you here with us again, Elliot Slosar.
Thanks, Jason. Thanks so much for having us on.
Now, Keith, you didn't always live in Elkhart, Indiana. You weren't born and raised there, right? You started off on the south side of Chicago. So tell us a little bit about that.
I grew up in a single family home. My mother was raising three of us. It was kind of rough. As I got older, I started having babies. And then I got married with my wife. You know, the violent rate was on the rise in Chicago during that time in the 90s. And I didn't want that kind of atmosphere around for my children. So we decided to move to Elkhart because she had family there. And I was like, okay, well, cool, I'll give it a shot. I was 28, going on 29. And I had three children at the time. And when I got there, everything started off smooth. It didn't take me no longer than 14 days before I got my first job at Banks Lumber. And life was great.
Yeah, it sounds like it. I mean, 29 years old, three kids, married, you know, more or less living what sounds like the, you know, personification of the American dream. And what's ironic is that you left Chicago, which had not only had a rise in crime at the time, but then the police were also very dangerous. The police in those days, and this is not hyperbole, were regularly torturing people. They were bringing them to a warehouse instead of the police station. Not just suspects, but also witnesses. They were subjecting them to beatings, genital electrocution, suffocation, putting bags over their head while they were chained to a wall, beating them with telephone books. And they did that not only to suspects, again, but also to witnesses in order to extract confessions, but also testimonies that they needed to make cases against others stick. So check out our coverage of Marcus Wiggins. He was their youngest victim, and he was 13 years old when they subjected him to this torture. We're going to have that linked in the bio as well. So anyway, you had jumped out of the literal frying pan into what you didn't know was another one in the form of the town of Elkhart, Indiana.
You're right. Elkhart is a city of manifest injustice. To date, there's been 5 exonerations from Elkhart. Our clinic represents another dozen. In terms of the number of wrongfully convicted people from there, you know, who knows what that number is? I'm sure there's hundreds more.
I mean, hundreds more. That would be crazy in a big city. But we're talking about a town of 50,000. Now, that's really disturbing. And as you can hear in our coverage of Andy Royer's case, which we're also going to link in the bio, there's coerced false witness statements, fraudulent fingerprint analysis, a false confession from a cognitively impaired man. And the kicker, the prosecutor watched it happen. And not only did she not stop it, but rather she used it to wrongfully convict not one, but 2 people in this case. And did I mention that she is the current elected prosecuting attorney for Elkhart County? And even more disturbing with how small of a town it is, all of these bad actors know one another, are aware of each other's misdeeds. And one of the detectives in the case we're going to cover today became the chief of police. And that lasted until 2018. And that's Ed Winbigler. And by the end of this episode, you're also going to be acutely aware of his partner, the lead detective in this case, Steve Rizzuco. Elliot, can you give us some background on Rizzuco?
You know, something that we would later obtain on the civil side of things was Rizzuco's application to the Elkhart Police Department. And so they conduct, you know, a background investigation of Rizzuco, and then they go to like 3 references that he actually lists. You know, this is like when you're applying to a job, you're like, hey, let me list like the 3 most favorable people to me in the world. And at each of those 3 places, they gave him terrible references. You know, one of the people was like, I would never hire him again. This guy was overly aggressive. You know, like every red flag.
He had bad credit, was deep in debt, going through a bankruptcy, several arrests for reckless driving, fighting, an accident with a parked car, and a high-speed chase with the police.
So nothing in this background investigation was like, Steve Rizzuco, let's give that guy a badge and a gun and see what he can do for the citizens of Elkhart.
But at least one former supervisor seemed to have found value in Rizzuco, saying, quote, he knew all the drunks, all the bandits, and all the prostitutes. He's a big guy, and he's been in some bar scrapes and come out the winner, end quote. This guy was an uber-aggressive dirtbag with plenty of friends in the underbelly of town. And what you'll come to know about this guy is that his MO was not solving crimes, but rather finding a target of his investigation, just fixing all the facts, and coercing not only suspects, but witnesses as well, to give statements that fit his target.
You know, this guy was willing to violate the constitutional rights of anyone in the community, especially people of color or people without financial resources to take him on, and got away with committing criminal offenses for decades.
And we'll go a bit further into what those criminal acts were later on. But bear in mind, he wasn't the only problematic dirtbag investigating this case. There's also Ed Winbigler, who eventually became the chief of police, and another detective named Steve Ambrose.
Steve Ambrose later was implicated in serious misconduct as well, including shooting and killing a black man in the Elkhart community by the name of Derek Connors. And everybody that I'd spoken to in Elkhart has serious concerns about whether Detective Ambrose murdered Derek Connors without justification. And there was an investigation into that, a lawsuit.
So this town that Keith had just moved to in search of a safe place to raise his family wasn't actually so safe with these guys protecting and serving. Now, not only was it unsafe for Keith and his family, but also another young man named Chris Parrish, who was also wrongly targeted by Rizzuco, Ambrose, and Windbigler. Now, Chris was almost 10 years younger than Keith and had grown up in Elkhart.
I think with Chris Parrish, something to keep in mind is he was a real young kid whose family had run-ins with the police department. And, you know, as we talk about this case, you'll see that the police went out of their way to manufacture a case against Chris Parrish when all the evidence credibly showed that he was innocent all along.
So it was these previous run-ins with the law, which were nothing serious, by the way, but they offered a motivation for the police to try to frame Chris, who already had a mugshot from when he was 14 years old, which made it even easier for them. But with you, Keith, you were brand new to town, unknown to local law enforcement, so you seemed like a pretty random choice, but they went ahead and did it anyway. Did you know Chris Parrish before all this happened?
No, I never knew Chris Parrish.
Yeah, so Christopher Parrish and Keith Cooper never met each other until a decade after Chris's exoneration. And, you know, a couple of years after Keith was exonerated, they had several defense attorneys. You know, Chris was from Elkhart, Keith was from Chicago. They lived different lives, frankly. They're in different age groups. You know, Keith was married with children. Chris was in his early 20s.
Yeah, Keith was like 9 years older than him and living a totally different lifestyle. So the idea that the two of you committed an armed robbery together on its face makes no sense. So let's get into the crime itself. Now, this incident may not have even happened in the way that the victim described it. The police really never did collect any evidence at the scene, but rather it was collected later for them by the alleged victims. But it's really all we have to go on. So on October 29, 1996, allegedly there were about six people in an apartment at a public housing project in Elkhart. 17-year-old Michael Kirshner, his mother Nona Cannell, and then about four of Michael's friends, including 15-year-old Eddie Love and another guy named Jason Ackley and two others. And they said that they were watching a movie, that ridiculous movie, Don't Be a Menace to South Central While Drinking Your Juice in the Hood, when they allegedly got a knock on the door from two black men, one short, one tall with a hat on, and they were looking for someone named Shell. Whether that was short for Michelle, we don't know.
In either event, they had the wrong apartment. According to the victims, you know, their account is that when they denied that Shell was there, these two guys forced their way into the apartment because the victims had like a bag of like laundry coins on the living room table, and there was an SKS rifle. Ultimately, there was a scuffle, and in the midst of the scuffle, one of the victims, Michael Kirshner, was shot.
Right. He allegedly got in between his mother and the gunman, which was the taller of the two assailants, and took a non-fatal gunshot to the abdomen, which, if true, is very heroic. Now, this taller gunman was the role in this crime that Keith later got saddled with. Also notable, by the way, during that tussle, the taller man's hat fell off.
Yeah, and it wasn't just any hat. You know, back in the 80s and 90s, you know, when they had malls, it was like one of those hats that you can customize. There were like rhinestones on it that form the letter J. Notably, you know, Keith Cooper doesn't have the letter J anywhere in his name. But when the shooter and the second person left the apartment, they left that hat. And on that hat was DNA evidence that has excluded Keith Cooper since the time of trial.
And we'll get into how that played out at trial in a bit. And from what I can understand, this hat and any other physical evidence from the scene, none of it was even initially collected by the police on the scene. What the hell is that all about?
There are two different perspectives to this. You know, later there was some evidence that came out during Chris Parrish's post-conviction litigation that alleged that the shooting happened in a parking lot. And if it happened in a parking lot, that might tend to explain why there wouldn't be any physical evidence in the apartment. There's a second explanation, which is that it's not just detectives in Elkhart that are completely incompetent, but also crime scene technicians. And so the crime scene technician, when he went there, he didn't actually do his job and look for physical evidence from the shooting. And so 2 days later, when the victims came home from the hospital, they were the ones who recovered the hat, the shell casings, called the police back, and that's when the Elkhart Police Department came and seized the physical evidence.
So there are some chain of custody issues from the get-go here. But nonetheless, they had some bullets, shell casings, the hat with the DNA that excludes Keith, and then the witnesses' descriptions, right? Two young black men, one was short and stocky, and then the tall gunman who had a long silver gun and was described as wiry. But I'm not sure if Keith ever was wiry. It certainly doesn't appear that way now.
Yeah, Keith is tall, but he's never been a wiry guy. You're totally right about that. And in this case, there was a composite that was created early on, and it's like the most generic looking composite you'll ever see. I mean, it like basically was a human being. There was no like detail to it that would like lead you one way or the other to who actually did the shooting.
And we'll link that in the bio as well. So this generic composite leaves room for a very loose interpretation as to which direction to take this investigation. So 2 days after the crime, one of the witnesses, a 15-year-old kid named Eddie Love, who may or may not have been at risk of his own charges, had a highly pressurized sit-down with Ed Winbigler. And it's been theorized that Winbigler may have been pushing the idea that Chris Parrish was involved. So what is the result of this conversation?
What's fascinating is there are like two different versions of this based on the reports. So like Detective Winbigler's report said that Eddie Love said that the person looked like a person he knew named Chris Parrish. He didn't say it was Chris Parrish. So he was like clearly telling the cops like, hey, you know, like I know this guy, Chris Parrish, the guy you're looking for looks like him. But Detective Rizzuto would later write a report saying that Eddie Love named Chris Parrish as the person who did this.
So whether they had already planned on doing this or not, they now have a reason to place Chris Parrish's photo in a lineup to be viewed by Michael Kirshner, Nona Cannell, and the other four robbery victims. Now, remember, they only had a picture of Chris from when he was 14, even though Chris was 20 years old at the time of the crime. So the lineup was totally suspect. Plus, they knew that he was in Chicago.
You know, which is about 2 hours from Elkhart, Indiana. And he had somewhere around 15 alibi witnesses who testified at his criminal trial, including a minister. And Rizzuto would testify later on in Chris's civil case. This is like 15 years later. I believed when the trial was over that Chris was going to be exonerated because I believed his alibi witnesses. That's a quote from Rizzuto. And it really is a striking admission because if you believe Chris Parrish's alibi witnesses that Chris is innocent, then how does a police officer somehow get a half dozen people to make a positive identification of Chris Parrish? Right? Both can't be true. Sure, maybe there's some statistical probability that one person could mistakenly pick Chris out of a photo array, but how do you get a half dozen people to mistakenly pick Chris Parrish out of a photo array? Well, you do it by putting a 14-year-old juvenile photo in an array with five adult men, knowing that they describe the person as younger looking, and you lead your eyewitnesses to misidentify somebody who's innocent.
So they made this suggestive array with Chris's juvenile photo and led the six witnesses to ID him. Chris was charged shortly after the actual incident to later be taken to trial. But Keith, you were brand new in town. They didn't even know you, let alone have a photo of you. So how did you get pulled into this?
It all started from they said I robbed this lady for a purse.
So a purse snatching happened, but Keith was like literally walking on the street, his car had broken down. He went to go get some like groceries, and the detective saw a tall black guy and was like, oh, there was a purse snatching with a tall black guy. Let me just bring this guy over. So he drove Keith over to the victim's house.
And I saw the lady on the porch with the other officer. And I'm saying to myself, how's she going to be able to identify me when I'm sitting in the back seat and they squad car with these little gates around the window where you can't even really see inside?
Was she white?
She was white. Yes, she was.
Okay, so we have a cross-racial identification from a distance through a window, which is screened, as you said, so
right.
You barely could see in at all. And the suggestive nature of it is extreme.
Right then and there, my life went to shit. When she identified me as the purse snatcher, that was a lot. When I got to the police station, a lot of things they did at the police station, it went untold. Because, see, they had me take a lie detector test to prove that I was innocent of that case. But it didn't do me no good because Rizzuto's had other plans for me.
And this is like from Detective Rizzuto's own mouth. You know, he's testified to this. Detective Rizzuto sees Keith in there and he's like, oh, tall black guy. That must be the tall black guy I'm looking for in the Kirshner shooting. I mean, like, it literally could have been like any tall black guy in America who could have been brought into that station, and their life would have been ripped away because Rizzuto just wanted to close the case instead of solve it.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
The Pacers Foundation is a proud supporter of this episode of Wrongful Conviction and of the Last Mile organization, which provides business and tech training to help incarcerated individuals successfully and permanently re-enter the workforce. The Pacers Foundation is committed to improving the lives of Hoosiers across Indiana, supporting organizations that are dedicated primarily to helping young people and students. For more information on the work of the Pacers Foundation or the Last Mile program, visit pacersfoundation.org or thelastmile.org.
Here you have two separate incidents involving a tall black man, and then both the purse-snatching detective and Rizzuto just picked out any old tall black guy. And it just happened to be Keith. Both times.
So you were in jail for 2 months awaiting trial on the purse snatching.
Correct.
How much was bail on that case?
It was $10,000, $1,000 to go to bond out.
And not having access to that money like so many other people, you're right. Stuck in this jail.
I'm stuck. I'm sitting, waiting trial. Right before I was getting ready to go to trial for the purse snatcher, I get a visitor. The visitor was Detective Rizzuto. He had me come down to his office and I sat down across from him. Told me, he said, hey, if you take this purse snatching case to trial, and if you do win this, I have another case for you. I said, I didn't commit this person. I said, let alone do anything else out here in Elkhart. He said, well, I got six people to say the difference. And he gave me a police report. And I'm reading it. And he tells me that you're the one who attempted to rob these people and shot Michael Kirshner. And at that time, I'm like, no. I said, I didn't do it. He said, well, you take this egg and you lay on it. Because if you get found out guilty of that battery, you will be faced with this here. And as I'm sitting there waiting for trial, and he was on the visit I was getting in the county jail. And each time he was letting me know that, hey, this is your baby. You sitting on that egg, y'all. You're going to get found guilty. That's what he was threatening me. After a couple of months went past, and I went to trial. I was acquitted of that there. Right when they were processing me out, they came with a bench warrant. And I asked him for what? And he said, attempted murder, armed robbery. Right then and there, I knew Rizzuto wasn't going to let me go home.
No, he was not. Like he had already explained to you, he had six people that were ready to identify you. And all of those IDs, with the exception of Eddie Love, were going to be cross-racial. Which, I'll say it again, in study after study, has been proven to be less accurate than guessing. So he had your picture now, and he put it into another suggestive lineup.
What's remarkable about Elkhart is even though they had the ability to do live lineups back in the 90s, they declined to do it. All of the identifications in this case were made on photo arrays. And if you look at the photo arrays, it's like, yeah, Cannell ID'd Keith, Kirshner ID'd Keith. And you're like, oh, wow, these are positive identifications. You know, there's no reports about, you know, confidence levels or whether they're done sequentially or together. And it took, frankly, about 15 years for that story to really unravel and for us to learn how those identifications were manufactured. So, you know, once we began the investigation into what was really going on, the victims told us all this information about the identification process. They told us that they were telling Rizzuto the whole time they didn't know if Keith Cooper was really the person. They actually were like demanding a live lineup to Detective Rizzuto, saying like, we want a live lineup because we're not sure. You know, we don't want to misidentify somebody. And he just kept telling them, I got the right guy. I got the right guy. He also told them that he didn't have enough tall black people in Elkhart to do a live lineup, which is also a lie.
It sounds like the basis for probable cause was a lie as well. These IDs were not positive IDs in the lead up to trial, but Rizzuco was able to shore them up later. In the meantime, leading up to trial, they had the DNA from the sweatband and the results came back telling the state definitively that Keith was not and could not have been involved, which should have put an end to this crazy prosecution.
Totally, like 100%. But instead, the state enters into the stipulation with this defense attorney that Keith had, saying that if the state lab analyst were to testify at trial, she would testify that the hat neither included nor excluded Keith Cooper from having worn it. And that is like the opposite of what the actual DNA results say, which is that like he's excluded from being a contributor to any of the DNA on the hat.
I'm finding it hard to understand why his attorney would do something so stupid. I mean, did you know that your attorney was allowing this shit to go on?
No. When the DNA, I felt confident that that's going to be the way I get out. But then they used the stipulation, which I didn't understand at the time what that word meant. My lawyer told me that when he agreed to that, that it was going to be into my favor if I agreed to the stipulation. I said, well, okay, cool.
What ended up happening at trial is like, you know, as in many of these cases, right? You've got police misconduct, you've got overzealous prosecutors, you know, they just want to get a conviction. And Keith had a defense attorney who was checked out.
Are we going to say his name?
Yeah, Jack Smeaton. He did not protect Keith Cooper at trial. And, you know, when I say trial, like that is like charitable. This was a half day bench proceeding that sent Keith to prison wrongfully for a decade of his life.
It's chilling to think that he said to you, he was actually being honest, but not in a good way, because he said, I'm going to take a bench trial so we can get this over with, right?
Right.
He was not. I mean, any lawyer would know that you're better off with 12 jurors where you only need one to say, hey, this doesn't make any sense.
I thought that way too. But he kept on telling me, he said, you better off facing the judge because the judge is familiar with the laws and I'd better for you to do it with this judge than have to go through them 12 people because the judge know more about your case than they do. And I like I said, I didn't know nothing about the system. So I went with what he was saying because he represented me. But he wasn't. He was just getting better. He just wanted me to cop out.
It seems like that's what the court was greased up to do. I don't even understand how the judge could have allowed that stipulation to come to pass, honestly, but everyone seemed on board with just ignoring the clear-cut evidence of your innocence leading up to trial, except for the people who didn't know about the DNA evidence, the eyewitnesses, who, it seems to me, were probably the only people trying to do the right thing here.
Cannell, Mike Kirshner, they like were so insistent regarding their doubts in this identification that Rizzuco was like, fine, show up to the courthouse at this time and meet me in this location. And the date was Keith Cooper's trial. The location was the hallway and the time was before the trial started. And so Rizzuco has these witnesses lined up in the hallway as Keith Cooper is walking up with his wife and children. And what the witnesses and the victims say is that Rizzuco turned to them and said, that's the guy. That's the guy who you're going to go in there and identify as the shooter. And they did what the cop told them to do.
So they trusted the detective that he had the right guy. Meanwhile, he knew otherwise all along. In fact, Rizzuco, Winbigler, and Ambrose knew that the case was so weak with the shaky IDs and DNA evidence exonerating Keith that they had to come up with even more bullshit.
So at some point prior to trial, Detective Rizzuco and Winbigler get a jailhouse informant involved named DeBerry Coleman. And they promised DeBerry Coleman his consideration and fed him information in order to fabricate a statement alleging that Keith confessed to him when they were incarcerated together. And at trial, one of the remarkable things here, DeBerry Coleman actually refused to testify there. And the judge allowed for a detective to testify to the statement that he took from the jailhouse informant without any defense having the ability to cross-examine the informant who is refusing to testify.
That is off the rails. Everybody who knows anything about the law or legal proceedings knows that there can be no testimony for either side unless the other side has an opportunity to counter it by cross-examining the witness. I've seen wrongful convictions happen for that reason.
Yeah, but apparently like Rizuka was like not convinced that Keith was going to get wrongfully convicted. And so like he goes out into the hall and gets this witness, Jason Ackley, who was at the time of the shooting in the shower. He's not in the living room when the shooting's going on. And he tells Ackley that he needs them to go in there and identify Cooper's voice as the voice that he heard through the walls while he's showering as the person who, you know, fired the shot. I mean, it's the most absurd thing. And so they bring this guy out from the hallway and they have Keith, you know, say some ridiculous thing in court. And Ackley's like, oh, yeah, that's the voice I heard.
Not only is voice recognition totally unreliable, but for anyone who's ever taken a shower, we all know that identifying a strange voice over the water, through the wall, and maybe the shower curtain or the glass door, and whatever else is between you and whatever is going on, this guy Ackley is totally full of it. So Keith, you'd watched all this go down. The eyewitnesses gave positive IDs in court. The judge allowed a detective to read in the jailhouse snitch statement after the snitch refused to testify. And your defense attorney entered into that DNA stipulation. Hell, this is a freaking bench trial. And the judge went ahead and allowed that stipulation. I mean, I don't know how you could have held out any hope that you'd still be acquitted after that.
No. Something my body told me, man, I was going to prison. When they agreed not to use the DNA, when they proved that I was innocent, that when it said inconclusive, when they threw that to the side, I knew I was going to prison. The judge's mind was already made up when we had recess. When we came off the recess, I was found guilty. I looked at my attorney, I said, how you let this happen? When the DNA was there, he said, well, I did what I could. It's like a little grimace grins about itself, you know, like, hey, I did what I can do.
Wow. I mean, this is really devastating just to hear about it. And you had to live through it. And then you got taken off to prison facing 40 years to life.
During my sentencing, I had told my wife she had to get on with her life. Don't worry about me because I can't help her or my three babies. I have to now worry about how I'm going to survive in this prison. And you have to worry about how you and the kids going to survive because I don't have no source of help. I can barely have myself now, this time. So, you know, I'm lost for words, and she lost for words, too. But we both got a journey on our own now, separate ways.
iHeartRadio and Grim and Mild present Bridgewater Season 2.
A lot of people now actually believe that there is some kind of mystical force in this region that attracts monsters and paranormal activity.
The Bridgewater Triangle. Now that sounds about right.
You're still denying that there's something beyond our understanding going on here?
Starring Supernatural's Misha Collins, The Walking Dead's Melissa Ponzio, and Rogue One's Alan Tudyk. Written by Lauren Shippen and created by me, Aaron Mankey.
Something about all of this doesn't feel right.
Hello? Is someone there?
Something went wrong here.
Olivia, we should hurry.
We have a much bigger problem.
What is that?
Olivia, run!
Listen to Bridgewater now on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And learn more over at grimandmild.com/Bridgewater.
Hey, I'm Lance Bass, host of the new iHeart podcast, Frosted Tips with Lance Bass. The hardest thing can be knowing who to turn to when questions arise or times get tough or you're at the end of the road.
Okay, I see what you're doing.
Do you ever think to yourself, what advice would Lance Bass and my favorite boy bands give me in this situation? If you do, you've come to the right place because I'm here to help. This I promise you.
Oh, God.
Seriously, I swear. And you won't have to send an SOS because I'll be there for you.
Oh, man.
And so my husband, Michael.
Hey, that's me.
Yep, we know that, Michael. And a different hot, sexy teen crush boy bander each week to guide you through life step by step.
Oh, not another one.
Mm-hmm. Kids, relationships, life in general can get messy. You may be thinking, this is the story of my life.
Oh, just stop now.
If so, tell everybody, yeah, everybody, about my new podcast and make sure to listen so we'll never, ever have to say bye-bye-bye. Listen to Frosted Tips with Lance Bass on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Attention, Bachelor Nation. He's back. The man who hosted some of America's most dramatic TV moments returns with a brand new tell-all podcast. The most dramatic podcast ever with Chris Harrison.
It's going to be difficult at times. It'll be funny. We'll push the envelope. But I promise you this, we have a lot to talk about.
For two decades, Chris Harrison saw it all. And now he's sharing the things he can't unsee.
I'm looking forward to getting this off my shoulders and repairing this, moving forward, and letting everybody hear from me.
What does Chris Harrison have to say now? You're going to want to find out.
I have not spoken publicly for 2 years about this. And I have a lot of thoughts. I think about this every day. Truly, every day of my life, I think about this and what I want to say.
Listen to the most dramatic podcast ever with Chris Harrison on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Wabash Valley, where they sent me to. It was the ride, the long ride down there that it took its toll on me, because I had to think about how I was going to survive in that prison. And the thought of me not seeing my babies again, that was taking a toll. The closer I got to that penitentiary, the more I realized I wasn't going to see my kids. You know, then when I got inside the penitentiary, I knew that was going to be my home for the next 40 years, if I live. And that was scary. Because I was in a place where I know nobody. Nobody. And then I had to deal with the mentality of the prison yard. Everybody in there is taking their frustration out on one another. And no matter how you try to avoid it, you couldn't shake it. It always presented itself where you had to knuckle up. You had to throw your hands. You had to fight. I was getting tired of people, man. Every morning, man, somebody's manhood's getting tested. It's like, I'm tired of fighting, man. I'm going to end up, man, actually committing a crime in this place. And I knew they was going to eventually kill me up in there.
How did you survive, and how did you maintain hope in a place that, I mean, hope was lost?
I got on my knees and I just prayed, man. I asked God. I said, God, you helped me get through this year. I wasn't really getting no help. Until I got appointed another lawyer, William Polanski. When he came into my life, that's when the hope, when everything began to change for me. After 9 years, it took me 9 years to see that little light. He said, man, I looked through your case. I see with the DNA here. I'm going to have them redo your DNA.
So, you know, Keith's case, you know, in the early 2000s, there was more DNA testing done on the hat, and they were able to run the profile from the sweatband through the CODIS database, and they got a hit to a person named Jelanis Urban, who was convicted of murder with a similar type weapon in a town that was less than 30 miles from Elkhart, and who matched the description that the witnesses really gave. So when the system fails and the wrong person goes in, it fails the victim's family, Keith Cooper and his family. But here's a situation where, like, because the detectives went so far out of their way to put an innocent guy in prison, the real perpetrator not only stayed free, but he actually committed another murder. If they had actually done their job originally, maybe they could have prevented that. So when the hit happened, Keith was litigating a post-conviction petition, and the judge gave Keith's attorney, who was at the public defender's office, and Keith a choice. Either he will grant a new trial, and at that point, the defense attorney who was representing Keith, you know, these victims, you know, they were identifying Keith for all he knew. You know, he didn't talk to them. And there was some fear by the attorney that Keith could get wrongfully convicted. Or the offer that was presented is that the state would modify Keith's sentence on the wrongful conviction to time served so that he could go home to his family.
I want to go home, because I had got a letter from my sister telling me that my family was living in a shelter. And that was what made me really want to sign that paper, man, so I can come home, because I didn't want my people living in the shelter, especially my little daughter, because I was locked up with these perverted guys. As you hear they tell their stories, how they find to get their victims. And that made me realize, man, I need to get up out of here as fast as possible.
That's a Sophie's choice. You know, yes, you get to go home to your family, but you get to live for the rest of your life as a convicted violent felon. You know, or of course, you have to go back to jail, await trial in a hellish place, which could take years to get back to another trial. And then you've already seen the worst of what the system has to offer. And you know they're capable of framing you and they can just do it again. So who would want to have to make that choice? I think for someone in Keith's position in Elkhart, Indiana at that time, it was probably the only rational choice to make.
When I got out in 2006, my kids didn't even know who I was. And I barely recognized them because they had grew up. They were teenagers now. They was just little babies when I went into them. You know, being raised without me in their life, they had some little resentments that I had to deal with. I had to let them know it wasn't like I just walked out your life. I was kidnapped. They took me out from y'all. You know, so that was a hard pill for all of us to swallow when we got reunited.
This is something that will have a lasting impact on them for as long as they live.
Right.
The children need their dad. They need their parents.
And we all right now. I mean, I'm so happy. I got my grandkids around me. They keep me motivated. You know, I might have missed out on raising my own kids, but at least my kids give me the luxury of raising their children. So I'm grateful.
What do they call you? Do they call you Grandpa, Gramps, Pop-Pop? What do they call you?
They call me Paw-Paw. They love their pawpaw.
That's great. And I understand you got remarried as well to your wife, Nicole Sladen Cooper, in 2010.
Oh, I love my wife. She's beautiful. She's been very supportive of me. And the person I got to give high honors to is God first, then my lawyer / brother / friend now, Ellis. So when he stepped and came into my life, I was given, man, I knew I had a chance, man, to make things right.
So, you know, I learned about Keith Cooper when I was investigating the case of his co-defendant, Christopher Parrish, who had already been exonerated. You know, he was in the middle of a civil lawsuit. I was like not even in law school yet when I was working on that as an investigator. And when I talked to the victims and they told me what Detective Rizzuto really did to get these false identifications, you know, I went back to the firm, to my boss, and I was like, Chad, Keith Cooper is super innocent. And these people all feel terrible that they ripped his life away. We've got to tell them. So I met Keith that way and ended up, you know, promising him, you know, that we would do everything that we can to help him get his name back.
Since your investigation of Keith's case really began with Chris Parrish's case, we need to revisit what that investigation and the civil suit uncovered. Now, he filed a wrongful conviction lawsuit in 2010, so take us through that.
During Parrish's civil lawsuit, Keith Cooper's wrongful conviction unraveled. The eyewitnesses revealed that they were manipulated into misidentifying Keith Cooper. The jailhouse informant, DeBerry Coleman, you know, he refused to testify at trial, right? So Coleman, you know, revealed like, hey, yeah, I didn't testify at trial because A, it was false, and B, they didn't satisfy their promises to me, and I wasn't going through with it. I wasn't going to let them get me up there to put an innocent guy in prison. Jason Ackley, the guy in the shower, testified that Detective Rizzuto was out in the hallway and just told him what to do, and he would do anything to help Detective Rizzuto and, you know, the family get a conviction. So he was just doing what Rizzuto said.
Parrish presented evidence that, A, Kirshner was shot in the parking lot outside the building and lied about it because he said it was in the apartment because he was on home detention for a gun charge. So that's a bombshell right there, okay? Then Love testified that police coerced him to identify Parrish. DNA tests conducted after the trial in the hat showed not Keith Cooper, of course, but as you said, DNA of a man named Jelonis Irvin, who was later convicted of murder.
It would later be proven that Detective Rizzuto, the same guy who was telling the eyewitnesses who to select in the hallway with Keith Cooper, was using a child photo of Chris Parrish so that they knew who to identify in his arrays. And then Rizzuto would later admit under oath that when he watched Chris Parrish's trial, this frame job that he like orchestrated, and he admitted in the deposition, like, they convinced me. I thought they were going to find him not guilty.
Right. I mean, the state's case had been laid to waste, right? It was just laying there in tatters. And there's still so much more that was revealed. And we'll get to that in a minute. But Keith's best shot at exoneration was an actual innocence pardon from the governor. And this was Governor Pence at the time. And it was filed in like 2013, right? Wasn't he released in 2006?
In Indiana, they had this real antiquated rule at the time where if you had been released from prison, then you had to wait 5 years to file a pardon or parole application.
So all of this information had already been accumulated. No one could deny his innocence. They couldn't have back in 2006, even though they would have tried. But now he's out and ready for the fight. So this goes in front of the Pardon and Parole Board. And there's an even better case made for then Governor Pence to do the right thing here.
What's remarkable is that the Pardon and Parole Board did a unanimous recommendation. They recommended the actual innocence pardon. The victim, Michael Kirshner, testified on Keith Cooper's behalf, apologized to him, told him what Detective Rizzuto did, you know, begged the Pardon and Parole Board to do the right thing, begged the governor to do the right thing. A number of other people gave statements. And probably, you know, the most critical thing was a letter from the trial prosecutor, who's now a judge in Elkhart, Judge Cristofino. It was a letter directed from the trial prosecutor to Governor Pence. And in the letter, Mr. Cristofino admitted that the evidence available to the state of Indiana at this time exonerates Keith Cooper, and justice demands that Mr. Cooper be pardoned. As an attorney, he begged the governor to undo Keith Cooper's tragic wrongful conviction. And then Pence sat on this thing for years. And instead, once he got nominated by Trump, they wrote a public letter that they submitted to the press saying that the governor wasn't going to act on the actual innocence pardon, even though his board unanimously recommended that it be granted, and telling Keith Cooper to go back to court and file a post-conviction petition. And we went back to court. We filed a post-conviction petition. We were going to call the bluff. What ended up happening is Keith's case became a political issue and a civil rights issue in Indiana during the gubernatorial election. There was even a debate where the candidates were each asked the question, will you pardon Keith Cooper in your first 30 days in office? That is how like big this got. And so the momentum could not be stopped.
I felt like a celebrity. I tell you that. God is good. He put me out there. When I heard that part, and I was at work on a forklift truck loading the FedEx up. And one of my guys ran on the back of the truck. He said, Keith, you just been pardoned. I didn't know. He said, man, you just been pardoned. I thought it was a game. He was just going to play. I said, man, I ain't got time for that. I'm loading this truck. Let me work. He said, come and look. And I looked. And there was Evan Holcomb pardoning Keith Cooper. And I couldn't do nothing, man. But as a man, I tried to hold back my feelings, but the tears just flooded. And everybody on my job, they was all happy because they had the word that got out. And on, I had to leave work. I was so excited. I was free. I went home and just got on my knees. Man, just let it all out. I just, tears is just overwhelming. And they were just flooding the wells of my eyes. Man, I couldn't stop them. And I was thankful because it was like a dream had just come true for me. The burden, all that weight that was on my chest, just 1,000 pounds was just lifted off my chest, man, and I was free. My name was cleared, and I made history in the state of Indiana.
The person who ultimately won that election, Governor Eric Holcomb, who was the lieutenant governor to Pence. Like, this is somebody who was on Pence's ticket previously. And within his first 30 days in office, he granted Keith Cooper the state of Indiana's only ever actual innocence pardon.
It's incredible. Finally, now comes the good stuff, right? Now you get to take these people to task. So, of course, in November 2019, Keith filed a federal lawsuit against the city of Elkhart and four of its police officers. What did you learn during the civil proceedings? Because this is deep.
Yeah, we ended up filing the civil lawsuit. You know, it was a federal lawsuit on behalf of Keith Cooper. We sued Detective Rizzuto, Wynn Bigler, Ambrose, and the city of Elkhart. And that civil lawsuit unraveled what is going to be decades of exonerations of people who were wrongfully convicted, just like Keith was. We ended up uncovering these internal affairs files that were never disclosed to Keith Cooper prior to his trial in Parrish's civil lawsuit. So like, not only was this stuff withheld on the criminal side from both of them, but like the city of Elkhart literally litigated an entire lawsuit without turning it over, which is shocking. But those internal affairs files showed two different internal affairs investigations into Detective Rizzuto, one in 1996, before Keith Cooper was ever wrongfully convicted, and another one in 2001. And the 1996 IA investigation, Detective Rizzuto admitted to paying an informant for sexual acts, and she was used as a witness in a homicide investigation, admitted to that. And the only thing that the department did was take away three of his vacation days. And in 2001, Detective Rizzuto was caught in another internal affairs investigation prompted by other law enforcement agencies coming into Elkhart and saying, we have evidence showing what your detective is doing, paying informants and prostitutes for sexual interactions dating back to 1994. Like, we have affidavits from these women who he was sexually assaulting, right? Like, there's no actual consent here when it's a law enforcement officer with a badge and a gun. Like, they don't really have a choice. But he was not only paying them for sexual interactions, but he was then fabricating statements for them to falsely implicate people in crimes, including murder. These people were going on the stand and testifying to frame innocent people like Keith Cooper. They ultimately sustained an allegation of malfeasance against him, which by definition is a criminal act. And he was allowed to resign. And then get this, between the time that the malfeasance finding happened and his resignation, a supervisor of his at the Elkhart Police Department and a supervisor in the Elkhart County Prosecutor's Office literally wrote letters of recommendation on letterhead to a different law enforcement agency so that he could get hired. And then the chief of police went to the Board of Public Safety and thanked Rizzuto for his years of public service. Like, nobody knew about it. They buried it. All these people that he helped frame for crimes he didn't commit, a lot of clients in ours who are still wrongfully in prison. And then they buried it. And then Elkhart allowed Rizzuto, even after he resigned with this malfeasance finding, they were allowing him to testify in criminal cases, like even murder trials, without ever disclosing it to the defense for years. And we uncovered that. We uncovered a ton of other misconduct and exculpatory information that was withheld. And we ultimately filed a motion for sanctions against Detective Rizzuto for committing perjury and withholding evidence, including dating back to the Parrish lawsuit. And we sent him written discovery requests that was like, name every informant you ever had. Tell us the name of every informant you ever had sexual interactions with. Tell us the name of every informant you had sexual interactions with that you used as a witness in a criminal investigation. And the night before his response to the sanctions was due, and the night before his written discovery responses was due, he committed suicide.
Wow. I mean, I'm sorry for his family, but the fact is that everyone's safer with him not being in a position to hurt other people and abuse his power. Again, I wish it was the only time I'd heard a story like that. You know, the DePippo and Krivak case in Westchester had similar levels of police criminality. And then there's that horrible cop in Kansas City from the Lamont McIntyre case and so many others. You know the one I'm talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
Golubsky, Jesus Christ.
There's one more wild thing, Jason, that our lawsuit uncovered. You know, the detective who assisted Rizzuto in fabricating a jailhouse informant statement, Ed Wimbigler, he would later rise to the ranks of chief of police. Like, he was chief of police in Elkhart through 2018. Like, this isn't even something that happened decades ago. And what we uncovered in Keith Cooper's civil lawsuit was that in the 1990s, there was a group of white officers in the Elkhart Police Department who refer to themselves as the Wolverines. Like, people in the department have testified about this. Everybody up to the mayor has testified that they knew about the existence of this group existing within the department. And people have testified that the Wolverines originated, the name originated from this movie called Red Dawn from the 1980s. Which is real timely, given what's going on with Russia. And Red Dawn was premised on this theme that a group of white suburban teenagers would resort to guerrilla warfare in order to keep invaders out of their community. And these officers apparently saw people of color as invaders of their community and resorted to police abuse, police misconduct, framing innocent people. And Mr. Winbigler actually has admitted under oath to being associated with this group. And so the existence of the Wolverines is going to further unravel Elkhart's epidemic with wrongful convictions, because those officers time and time again have been implicated in framing other innocent people for crimes they didn't commit.
I hate to say it, but it's almost like the Catholic Church. You know, you go to whichever city you go to and you hear stories like this. We hear it day in and day out here as we interview people like Keith who've been through this.
So since you've pursued civil litigation in Indiana, that means you forfeited the right to state compensation. But aren't you glad you did? Because after hearing all the things that Elliot has been able to uncover here, which is nothing short of incredible, by the way, you were able to win your civil suit. I mean, he really drew out the truth here, and no one could hide from it.
The truth never changes, no matter how long it takes. The truth always remains the same. I stay with my truth, and God prevail. They can say whatever they want to say. In the end, God prevail. And he's not done with Elkhart either. A whole lot of truth for to come out of Elkhart.
Yes, sir.
Amen.
So we have a tradition here. Wrongful conviction. It's called closing arguments. It's how we close the show. And it works like this. First of all, I thank each of you guys for being here and sharing this truly incredible story. And then I'm going to turn my microphone off, kick back in my chair with my headphones on, and just listen to anything else you want to share with me and our incredible audience. Elliot, let's let you go first. Tell us what's on your mind, and then Keith can take us out.
The epidemic in Elkhart is only beginning to unravel. You know, there are so many other Keith Coopers who continue to be wrongfully incarcerated, whether they were framed by Detective Rizzuto or other members of the Elkhart Police Department. But one thing that Keith did through his fight over the past 26 years is shine a light on a community that was riddled with police and prosecutorial misconduct. And Keith, through shining that light, will be the main reason why so many other wrongfully convicted people will be set free. You know, recently, in 7.5 million different ways, the city of Elkhart acknowledged the egregious wrong and suffering that happened to Keith Cooper. And it's no coincidence that Keith received the largest wrongful conviction settlement in the state of Indiana. That settlement is a result of everything that Keith unearthed and that the city of Elkhart did not want a jury to hear. So while Keith's story is heartbreaking and tragic and so preventable, you'll be hearing about a lot of other Keith Coopers being set free from Elkhart in the years to come.
I just want to let the people know, man, that the justice system can be fixed. And there's people out here that's working every day to see that folks like myself that were wrongfully convicted do have a chance to get out, because there's people out here working and they looking into cases and they digging up the dirt on these wrongful, unlawful police, prosecutors, even state's attorneys, and even the judges. They coming after them. As long as they keep their hope and stay in their faith, whatever their faith may be, stay with it. Because God gonna send these folks back here. These people are out here to help. And I love that. That's where I close.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction. I'd like to thank our production team, Connor Hall, Jeff Clyburn, and Kevin Wardis, with research by Lila Robinson. The music in this production was supplied by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Wrongful Conviction, on Facebook at Wrongful Conviction Podcast, and on Twitter at Wrong Conviction, as well as at Lava for Good on all 3 platforms. You can also follow me on both TikTok and Instagram at It's Jason Flom. Wrongful Conviction is a production of Lava for Good Podcast in association with Signal Company No. 1.
In 1968, 5 black girls were picked up by police after running away from a reform school in Mount Meigs, Alabama. I'm writer and reporter Josie Duffy Rice, and in a new podcast, I investigate the abuse that thousands of black children suffered at the Alabama Industrial School for Negro Children and how those 5 girls changed everything. Listen to Unreformed on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
In 1980, cocaine was captivating and corrupting Miami.
The cartels, they just killed everybody that was home.
Setting an aspiring private investigator on a collision course with corruption and multiple murders.
The detective agency would turn out to be a front for our drug pilot, who would claim he did it all for the CIA.
I'm Lauren Bright Pacheco. Join me for Murder in Miami.
Talk about walking into the devil's den.
Listen to Murder in Miami on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
On the new podcast, The Turning, Room of Mirrors, we look beneath the delicate veneer of American ballet and the culture formed by its most influential figure, George Balanchine.
He used to say, "What are you looking at, dear? You can't see you, only I can see you."
What you're doing is larger than yourself, almost like a religion.
Like he was a god.
Listen to The Turning, Room of Mirrors on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.